All right, good news. The nose is back. We shut down the nose. Can you shut down a nose? We shut down the nose for a few weeks here, and we're ready to get back, plunge back into the waters of culture. Again, Tanisha Dugan is with us, a producing associate at TheaterWorks, and Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance, and so much more. Bill Usman is a professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University. And I am just me. So we're going to, a little bit later in the show, talk about a movie we all saw. Carolyn's main contribution is going to be explaining how hard it was for her to see this movie, which is, in fact, a contribution she often makes. But this time she really has sort of a Homeric odyssey that she can describe. We're going to talk about other things as well. A little bit later, we'll talk about a feature in New York Magazine in which comedians talk about jokes they regret telling and why and how they think about it. We're also going to talk, we hope, about the refashion Miss America, Miss America 2.0. But first, even as we bid farewell to Cynthia Nixon. I mean, we'll never totally bid farewell to Cynthia Nixon, but her gubernatorial aspirations, anyway, are going into that good night. But we still have left in our mouth the strange taste of a bagel, a cinnamon raisin bagel with cream cheese and lox. And for some reason or – well, I understand, as somebody who's covered politics for a long time, why this caused such a stir. But maybe we need to talk about whether it should have caused such a stir. So, Tanisha, I'm going to have you kick this one off. I mean, my sense is that maybe she should –
That I have weird tastes in bagels as well.
Or maybe you're are you opposed to bagel shaming?
I'm not. I actually like a weird bagel myself.
Well, that would mean you were opposed to bagel shaming. I know it's complicated.
It is very complicated.
That is very complicated.
I'm opposed to shaming. Let's start there. But I love this idea that we are so into the minutiae of what her order is as we're trying to find out this sort of everyday life of Cynthia Nixon. What is a day in the life of politician Cynthia Nixon? And it includes this cinnamon raisin and lox bagel. I love that sort of weird reality TV tidbit. I think it gets odd in the case of this, you know, story, because it is such a non-story.
But I think there's nothing more New York than judging someone for their bagel taste, right?
Or judging someone, period, right?
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, it's all unsurprising.
I'm judging the three of you right now. I hope you can tell.
Well, you're shaming us, too. But so, well, Bill, there's a whole kind of uncoding that goes on with all this stuff. Although I think it makes sense to sort of dichotomize it a little bit, all right? So politicians, they go around a lot of places and they eat food. And a lot of times it's you're in a new place, you're in a place where you don't belong. Can you understand our ways? Mm. Can you master the code, the local code? And so this results in a lot of pictures of people like Rick Perry eating corn dogs at an Iowa fair in a way that really looks like, well, you can imagine what it looks like. Anyway, and it results in like probably the most kind of fly-specked question, maybe literally, is the Philly cheesesteak, where politicians come in and they order it the wrong way. John Kerry got in trouble for wanting Swiss cheese on it. I think Scott Walker wanted American cheese. You're supposed to get cheese whiz. Well, you're supposed to say sauce and whiz or onions and whiz, which is not something you typically say that you want on your food, whiz. But but this is a little different. This isn't about mastering our ways. This is more about, are you one of us?
Yeah. You did a show recently on semiotics, right? So the semiotics of, you know, what was on that bagel is fascinating to me because it's about authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how this gets challenged. Like, as a Jewish American, mm-hmm. and I love when people start statements like that, as a Jewish American
and a woman,
I found this very offensive. I was deeply offended by this choice. But I'm also someone, like, I've argued with my wife about what a real bagel is or not. And there's a very small number. You can get a plain bagel, an egg bagel, sesame seed, poppy seed, and maybe marble. But anything else.
But no rainbow bagel?
No, none of that.
What about cheddar?
And a, no. Okay, I actually like it. But, you know, like a blueberry bagel, get out of here with that. I'm not, you know. So when, it's about authenticity.
Authentically honoring her taste buds for sure. And there is something to be said about this sort of confluence of flavors, right? She's got a little bit of Jewish flavor. She's got a little bit of.
And didn't she explain, like, she likes that, like, sweet and salty?
No, I'm pushing back. It's just disgusting.
Although, Tanisha, I think you make a great point. Which is, you know, you want authenticity from somebody. What's more authentic than ordering what you want
exactly.
in defiance of the norms?
But that's not how authenticity
works, right? I understand this. So I was up in the Catskills this summer, and I went to this place that has these crazy donuts. Like, they hand make these donuts, and then they have, like, all these toppings you can put on them. And I got judged by the woman, this, like, lovely woman at this donut shop up in the rural Catskills, because I wanted my donut to have fruity pebbles, bacon, and the, like, maple drizzle on top. Because to me, that was, like...
That is disgusting.
It
and
was delicious.
Unnecessary. I mean, really, the best donut is
but
a glazed
donut. But, you know, like,
donut.
They had all these
no,
options.
No, there's someone very close to me who would embrace that choice completely.
Right. I thought it was, you know, and the woman was kind of like, we've never done that before. And I was like, well, you said you can have any toppings you want on your donut. Like, don't judge me for doing any toppings I want. So I get it. Like,
Did she give it to you?
Yeah. And when I said it was delicious, she kind of sarcastically was like, I'll have to try that sometime.
She's not trying it.
She's never going to try it. They're not adding that to the menu or anything. So,
they have
I mean,
picture up
they'll
in
call
the
it,
kitchen now.
They'll call it the pain donut. Double meaning.
Donut
there.
Of pain.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is there anything else that we have to say about this?
I have to say what I do love about it, and I think it says a lot for who she was as a candidate, and it is someone, like you said, and it's sort of a repeat of what you just said, is somebody who was going to say what was on her mind, eat what she wanted, and defy this dog and pony show that is what it is to be a politician. Yes, she could have had a sesame bagel with cream cheese and lox and capers and red onion and been called the quintessential, you know, New Yorker. And that is, I would say, definitively singular in the definition of what it means to be one.
I'm convinced this is what took her down rather than the Cuomo
I was just
New
about
York
to ask,
machine.
Is this what
it
was her
It had nothing
downfall.
To do with Cuomo's power, right? It was purely it the bagel.
True.
Well, I think it's a fake test in this case. I understand why people get tested that way. My favorite one of all time, I can't place the year anymore, but Steve Forbes was briefly running for president. He was up in New Hampshire, and I think Michael Lewis wrote about this, that he was at like some Kiwanis tent thing where you go through a line and you put stuff on your plate, you know, kind of a buffet kind of thing, but probably with one of those plastic plates with little indentations for. Anyway, he was very carefully watching the couple of people ahead of him to see what they did. And it was really clear that Steve Forbes, who of course was raised in the lap of luxury.
And
never,
an android.
Yeah, and kind of an android anyway. Yeah. So he was like trying to learn the ways of you earthlings, you know, watching what they're doing. And that to me, that does tell you something. That actually has some kind of semiotic purpose. Mm. But if she just wants – if Cynthia Nixon, who like lives in New York, you know, and probably orders a lot of bagels, if that's the kind of bagel she likes, I just can't imagine why that's anybody's business.
So here's the question. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're moving away from that Steve Forbes version of being of the people? Do you think we're moving? Do you think this Trump has put us in this place where – Steve Forbes maybe wouldn't have to do that thing anymore where he had to eat the food that he would never want to eat because it looks like what folks in Chicago. Could he just have a regular hot dog and not – or a thin slice of pizza and not have to have the deep dish because it's in Chicago?
If there are not pictures coming back to us in the next 6 to 8 months of Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren and all kinds of people – eating corn dogs at Iowa fairs, I will give you $20.
Trump would have put three tacos on top of it.
Yeah. To be frank.
You know.
Well, we should probably switch gears a little bit just so we have time for everything, particularly because we have decided that we do want to talk about – I sort of thought this panel would not want to talk about Miss America, but I'm wrong.
I didn't.
You didn't want to. Well, there are people who did. And so
I'm an old school fan.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, we're going to come to that. We're going to come to that.
I actually watched it.
We have to get through the comedians first. So one of the things that New York Magazine has done is they've interviewed a bunch of comedians about a joke that you regret telling. Now, most of these jokes are jokes that I cannot read on the air because they are, in fact, regrettable jokes. And even if they weren't regrettable jokes, I still couldn't read them on the air because they are profane, let us say. And a lot of them do – a lot of the comedians regretted using people with disabilities, you know, as comic crutches. You can sort of get that. But a lot of them are also just kind of reprocessing everything in the light of 2018 and Me Too and body shaming and stuff like that. Although, I don't know, Carolyn, it's if you start removing everything –
No. There's nothing. What can you say?
Yeah, I don't know. How as a comedian, did you react to all this?
You know, I feel like comedy, before the show, we were talking about safe spaces. And comedy kind of needs to be that safe space, but within reason. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are certain things. Part of comedy is kind of like, you know, poking the fire and trying to... and getting that chance to kind of like say things and challenge people. But there you don't... You can make people uncomfortable, but not to the point where somebody is gonna feel hurt. I think that so I in reading this, there were some that literally like you did bristle at that where it's just like there is no way that is ever going to be funny. Mm-hmm. But you know, some of them. Yeah, you think so?
Well, you're seeing my,
go.
I'm moving my body. I think it's about what does funny mean, right? And like that response of laughter to me is about not quite knowing what to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a particular joke in the article that we all bristled at. But what I think is interesting about even pushing too far into offense is that you begin to know as a society where that line is. And I think we're strangely in a space because we're always trying to create safe space that we actually don't know the boundaries of safe and hard. And I think hard is not comfortable, and hard can elicit laughter as you're going through it, but you don't get to something better for all of us. Like, I don't get to be a better person. I don't get to know what pushes your buttons until you tell me that. And sometimes that's different for the professor than it is for the comedian. And those are things that we learn in practice in real time and can't be glossed over by like a general, I feel this is safe and therefore I'm going to put upon you that this is your safe as well.
And you also can't predict what people are going to find offensive. So speaking of being a professor, at least 10% of my professing is comedy. And one time in class, we were talking about this famous case study of, you know, this panic that happened after an Orson Welles radio broadcast, and it happened in New Jersey. And I made a joke about, well, of course, if Martians were going to land, they were going to land in New Jersey, and how could you tell?
Stage shaming.
Ba-dum, bum.
Right, right.
A student came up to me after class and said, I just want you to know I'm from New Jersey and I'm really sick and tired of these kind of jokes. And I had to apologize.
Right.
Like I had to own, right, that I had offended her in that moment. But I do think it's about context. I don't like the idea of making a blanket statement that some things are off limits for comedy. I'm not sure whether you can make an Auschwitz joke or not, but I do know you can't make an Auschwitz joke at Auschwitz.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So the venue is really important.
Yeah.
I should say just very quickly. I mean, I could talk about this for 4 hours, but yeah. Back when I was on AM radio for 16 years, I was much more of a brat and not exactly a shock jock, but a lot of times I was sort of trying stuff out because you're on the air for 3 hours and you're right. Just like, let's see if this is funny.
Right.
And that's a terrible thing to do because so many thousands of people are listening. They didn't necessarily choose to listen to somebody who's maybe going to try something like this. And I had this – talk about regrets. I have this list – I have a list of people that I should just call and say, I'm really sorry I said that, you know, but I'd be on the phone all day doing that. Now, Carolyn, to your point, I feel like when people come to a comedy venue, they've made a certain set of choices. You know, they have decided that they are going to go someplace
and to open themselves up to be pushed and to be challenged. So, but again, it depends on venue. One of the worst, Colin knows about this, one of the worst experiences I've ever had as a comic is I had to perform at a retirement home. They had hired comedians, like good comics, good locally based comics, and we had to perform at this retirement community, and it was awful. Like, nothing I could say was landing. It was like I was just accidentally offensive. I had a woman completely attack me. I got heckled by like a 90-year-old. It was the worst, one of the worst experiences on stage ever. And this is material that I had really cultivated and I felt really solid with. But first, it just was not. It was not the audience where somehow me making fun of Netflix, which they didn't understand, then they took as a personal affront. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine a joke about Netflix getting flipped into a personal affront against, you know, with ageism.
Netflix and kill.
Yeah. I think that sometimes it is where you're saying it, not just how you're saying it or what you're saying. It's where you're saying it.
And who's saying it, too, right? There are jokes that Tanisha can make that I can't make. Yep.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yep.
And I think it's okay to own that.
Well, I think that's the space that we are occupying right now, right? That this idea that something that's for me may not be for you. Mm-hmm. And I think we're all, I think collectively, because I don't buck against this personally, but I think collectively we're bucking up against, oh, I can't say that word, but you can. Oh, I can't do that thing, but you right. can. And it's like, well, yes, actually, there is some societal rules that have determined what you can do and what I can't do. And that follows down many paths.
I think also just from the structure of comedy, it's, you know, I mean, it is hard to make a rule. You know, there's almost no rule that will hold up. It's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. You just can't really quite get there. I mean, I'll give the most offensive example I can think of, which is I would say as a rule, there's just no room in comedy for talking about mental retardation, except that Sarah Silverman does it a lot. She does it in a way that, as she says, makes fun of the person talking. She has this comic persona who says wrong things, you know, who just completely gets everything wrong. But I still would completely understand, you know, if somebody found what she was saying unbelievably offensive and out of line. But still, it's hard to make a rule, you know.
It is, and yet I see, you know, Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor on the other side looking at us having this conversation and thinking, I don't even know what, like, what industry did I work in that we're now having this conversation?
But I think it often does come down to that classic thing, and it's almost become a cliche. Are you punching up or are you punching down?
Yeah.
I don't find punching down funny.
No.
Like, there's just
some
nothing
would say
funny
punching,
about it.
Period. And I think that's
well,
the point.
Okay.
Yeah. Most people are saying punching isn't good.
Right.
So
but
don't
I,
punch anywhere.
See, I'm not so sure about that because it's a metaphor, right? So and I do know I don't want comedians to become timid. Because if comedians become timid, then
we all lose.
We're in trouble.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or some of us lose. Well, I would recommend
no,
people.
No, we all lose. Yeah. I think we all lose. The edges of who we are
that's
right.
what
needs
makes it
to
great.
Be questioned.
The greatest stuff is the stuff that's not timid. Mm.
A great coda to this conversation would be to watch Bill Burr's new special, Walk Your Way Out. It is not Bill Burr's best comedy performance. And I think, significantly, he did it in a very famous auditorium in Nashville where the audience is not really entirely on his side. Hmm. And he works with that a lot. Bill Burr is kind of famous among comedians for working with hostile crowds. He has this legendary thing he did in Philadelphia where he insisted on just, you know, badgering the crowd for 15 minutes. But it's really interesting because it's very much about sort of pressing back against whatever the new set of rules are. Bill Burr, being Bill Burr, does not want to follow them. I would also just quickly say that on Saturday night, I will be at CT Improv doing this combination of improv and stand-up. It's not something where I can plan my set, but I will probably say some pretty horrible things, so don't bring your children or
be forewarned.
Your sensibilities. Yeah. Wolfie will be on before me at 7 o'clock with her Asking for a Friend
nice.
Show. So, but yes, at 9 o'clock, I will say bad things.
Yeah. That's a good sweet and salty combo.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
You've got Asking for a Friend kind of gets you
that
in a good
is
space
like
and
a
then
cinnamon raisin bagel with lox on it.
Well, the CT Improv people are always, I do this about once a year with CT Improv, and they're always a little bit aware of the fact that I am going to drag them down into hell in a way that they're not usually going. But they know that's coming. Anyway, so we should do one last switch here over to Miss America. Bill, I'm going to have you get us started because you actually watched Miss America.
Watched every minute of Miss America because my wife really loves that stuff. And you can make the joke about, like, sure, that's why you watched it. So just the setup is that this is like Miss America 2.0, like the rebranding, the woke Miss America, no more swimsuit.
Don't ever use that word.
There were air quotes around it. no more swimsuits, and it's all about empowerment. The opening was so awkward, with just really pushing this, you know, I'm a smart woman and I'm confident and I'm strong and I'm a nuclear physicist. And I just found it completely awkward. And I found the whole thing to be really faux, because
instead of woke.
It was faux woke.
Faux woke.
Faux woke.
That's going to be a thing.
That's my new t-shirt.
Yeah. Faux woke.
No. Don't do it. Walk away from that one.
But, like, this whole thing that it's not still purely a beauty pageant is just nonsense. Because, you know, yes,
it
okay,
is.
There's
and,
more diversity
and it's
than
okay.
you used to be, but they're all still beautiful. Really beautiful young women.
Because that's what it is, and that's okay.
Within a pretty narrow range of what we consider acceptable beauty.
So they all had it, like, going on in the conventional sense?
I think so.
But that's the point. That is the whole point.
Right. I mean, like, how they would have to completely, like, retool the
They would
whole...
have to not do it.
Pretty much.
So there's, okay, I'm going to show the fact that I'm a young mom. So there's an episode of Boss Baby, the show, where they have this baby pageant. And the whole point is that this sort of subversive baby is trying to get them to cancel the baby show altogether because all babies are wonderful, right? And I think that is the essential premise of this 2.0 version of this beauty pageant. It's this idea that all women are beautiful no matter what. But there's something for me, and maybe there's some nostalgia, and perhaps someone will psychologically dig into why I love this. I like seeing beautiful women, and I like to perform beauty, whatever that means to me, as a person. So I'm totally okay with it. I loved it as a kid. Mm. You can dig into that however you want to. But I don't think that there's something fundamentally wrong with women who recognize that they're beautiful and want to use that as one of their tools. I mean, I think that's, to me, the conversation around feminism right now is, like, is it okay for women to, A, recognize their beauty and their sexual power, and B, use it
to their
advantage?
Yeah, but harnessing your beauty and sexual power and using that as part of who you are in life, I think that that's different than a beauty pageant where it's like there's that objectification.
Well, it's competitive, but to say that we don't use our intellect in a competitive way is disingenuous to me.
Right, but this isn't like an intellect pageant still.
Right, but
it's not like
whatever,
like on Arrested Development when they have the inner beauty pageant.
Right, but whatever your strong suits are, you're using them to the best of your advantage, and you're using them to assert yourself in some way in this world. That is what it is. We can argue whether or not we're okay with that, but we all use what tools we got to get
I completely agree. So, Miss America wasn't even on my radar until this show. Like, I didn't even realize it had happened.
I come at this from having known, in some cases pretty well, a whole bunch of Miss Connecticuts.
Might I ask?
Well, I mean, a lot of them used to come on my show back when I had that show on WTIC. But, I mean, some of them, they kind of stayed with it. Heidi Voigt, who might be listening right now, a former Miss Connecticut, who could be on the nose quite effortlessly, by the way. She'd fit right in here. I mean, I knew a lot of Miss Connecticuts, and I would say only one or two of them would fall into the category. You're probably not allowed to say bimbo anymore.
No, you're not.
But whatever that word, whatever the new word for that is, you know, maybe
beautiful
there were one or two of them.
Not smart.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, there you go. Most of them were very canny, smart people who were also interested in doing something with their lives, doing something good with their lives. You know, and this they were comfortable with the tropes of this pageant, including sashes and evening gowns and swimsuits and stuff like that. The only thing that I feel bad about with all that is that sometimes that swimsuit picture will follow you around the rest of your life. You know, you get a new job as a meteorologist in a new market, and they just they find the picture of you in the red swimsuit and put it up there. And, like, ultimately, these people, they go on to be people. I mean, Heidi Voigt just has twins, and she's working in television. And, you know, I mean, she's got a life now. I mean, you shouldn't just – the problem with that pageant is it can define you for the rest of your life.
But in 2018, in a world of Instagram, people
everyone has a swimsuit picture,
and
no one
cares, and in fact is using it.
Good point.
Yeah.
And actually, that's probably part of why their ratings are going down. Their ratings went down this year, but their ratings have been going down steadily since 2013, partly because, you know, as we're going to get to in a couple of seconds, there's the internets. You just type girl in swimsuit, click pictures, yeah. Images, I guess is what you click, yeah. And you'll see lots of them. So, and also there's football on at Sunday nights. So the kind of people who want to see women walk around in high heels and bathing suits are also the kind of people who like the NFL. It's obviously eaten into their ratings in lots of ways. So I don't know. Well, I mean, final verdict here. Okay, well, you say okay. No good can come from this.
No, I mean, I think it's fine. I just it's not my thing to watch. It wouldn't have ever been my thing to do, and you know. But I think everyone should get to if that is your dream. If your dream is to be a Miss America and kind of go through that journey, then that's fine.
All right, Bill.
I have no problem with a celebration of physical beauty. My problem, and this is, you know, this isn't my original idea, it's that it's physical beauty within such a narrowly defined limit of what physical beauty is.
All right. Tanisha?
I say you can cancel it and have either just the Victoria's Secret fashion show or the Rihanna, you know, Fenty Savage collection and get the same thing.
The last thing we should say is congratulations to Miss Connecticut this time. She was first runner-up, which means if anything goes off the rails with the current Miss America, she'll be Miss America.
I really did like her moonwalking during Irish step dancing.
That was a heck of a day.
She won the talent competition by doing Irish step dancing and then kind of segueing into moonwalking, which I think as people from Connecticut, we can all be proud of Bridget Oei. It's O-E-I, I think. I don't have to learn how to pronounce it yet. But anyway, good for you, Bridget. Come by the studio sometime. I'd like to meet another Miss Connecticut. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We got a movie to talk about, and Carolyn's got to go see it in some other state.
And come through an Atlantic City. She may turn out to be the queen of femininity.
Oh, the things you miss by. We should charge, like the way Slate does, we should charge you $25 to hear what we talk about
for
during
the
breaks.
Yes.
We would all need lawyers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, things would get complicated. There's no question about that. All right, so we all went to the movies. Some of us were able to do this a little bit more seamlessly than others. The movie is Searching. It's by a first-time feature director. It's also notable, the first big-budget or fully feature thriller, major box office thriller starring with an Asian-American star, John Cho, who's terrific. I mean, just generally terrific. It is the story of a man whose daughter has disappeared. But there's a gimmick. The gimmick is that everything in the movie, well, almost everything in the movie, is seen on a computer screen. The notion being this is how we understand our realities anyway these days. He tries to find out who his daughter was by looking at her computer. He tries to find out where she is now by looking at his computer and so forth and so on. I guess before we actually even talk about the movie, we have to briefly talk about your wanderings.
Okay. So I went to try to see this movie as we were committed to do. And my boyfriend is a doctor. With his schedule, we were trying to rush to go to a 6:20. That didn't happen. The next one was a 9:20 at the close movie theater. We get to that movie theater. We're in the ticket line, and the guy's like, no, I'm sorry. The projector broke. We can't play that movie tonight. We had to then drive like maniacs several towns away in 25 minutes to try to get to the next possible showing, because it's not really at a huge amount of theaters around here. We get to that theater, we buy our popcorn, our tickets, we sit down, we're waiting 20 minutes, the movie does not come on. We find out it's not going to work at that theater. Long story short, we ended up having to go to a third theater in another state and see this movie. At that point, this movie would have had to have been the best thing I've ever seen for me to even remotely like it.
Right. And your boyfriend, who had been looking forward to seeing the movie, fell asleep, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with that framework, let's hear a little bit from the movie. Actually, this is from the trailer. This is a movie that often there are not clips these days. In this movie, you can sort of understand why they don't want to have clips. But here it goes.
I'm Margo.
I haven't been able to reach Margo. When was the last time you saw her?
The study group only went till 9.
I think we're gonna go late.
No, she definitely left at 9.
I'm Margo.
Did she mention anything unusual? Was she acting strange?
I'm Margo.
Where are you?
She's been transferring funds for the last 6 months.
I'm Margo.
We found blood in the vehicle.
How did David respond?
These problems usually start in the household.
Mr. Kim, is everything okay?
Everything is great. Margo and I are great.
She had cash in her car.
He felt bad about everything.
She was my best friend.
Oh my God.
Told me she ran away!
I didn't know her. I didn't know my daughter.
The first thing to say about this is that that's from the trailer, and the movie sounds nothing like that. I actually know the guy who did the sound design, Nathan Rule, and there's a real interesting hush that sits over most of the movie. You know, there's music, and but just in the way that the computer environment is not noisy unless you intentionally make it noisy. There's a way in which the hush that is this movie steals over you, and if it's going to exert any influence or power over you, but it's part of that it doesn't have noises like what you just heard. So we'll get back to Krabby Pants over here in just a second. But Janisha, how did this movie land for you?
In a lot of ways. I'm actually going to back up a little bit to your earlier point about who is starring in the show and how it's just been really fascinating to me how Asian Americans in film right now are occupying this space where they are doing work that has nothing to do with their Asianness. And that's just fascinating to me as a Black woman making performing art, because Black performing art is always or most often centered on Blackness. And so I'm curious if we'll see anything in the near future in which Asianness and what it means to be Asian in America is actually something that filmmakers endeavor into. I'd like to know the answer to that question because I think it aligns to some questions I'm asking myself about what it means to live in this world. That being said, unlike most movies where you're like, oh, I know what this movie's about and I want to go see it because of XYZ, like Carolyn, because I knew I was coming to join you all today, I was going to see this movie and I went in completely blind. So as the movie starts, I'm like, what is happening? And as I started to piece together a very early plot point, I had to do that thing that most people would hate, but in this particular movie theater, it was okay. I took my phone out to Google the plot because I just was like, okay, I need to know because I'm the person who reads the last pages of books. Like, I need to know where this is going. And so for me as a mom, it was an interesting sort of parable, I think that's too strong of a word, of what it means to raise kids in this internet age and what it means to know somebody. And it was total emotional porn, which I thought was an interesting way into this world we live in. And I was most struck by this scene where a friend of the girl that goes missing, who claims very early to her father that she's not a friend, sort of turns around and claims this deep relationship with her for the sake of internet fame. And it just felt like a real crystallization of where we are today. And that, I think that scene particularly was the thing that I carried with me when I walked out.
All right. How about you, Bill?
You know how there's I saw this film almost a week ago. You know how there's films that after you sit with them for a while, you like them a lot better. You keep thinking about them. Mm-hmm. This is not one of them for me. The further I get away from it, the less I like it. It just didn't work for me as a movie. There were a couple things about it that I should have responded to. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the central device of the film is that it's all told through screens.
Right.
And so you're looking at a big screen, but looking at other screens within that screen. And that's very meta. And as someone who teaches about screen culture, I should have been really interested in that. But to me, it came off just as a gimmick. Like
I
a good idea.
If that's generational, you know? And like,
Are you calling me old?
I'm not shaming in any way, but I'm asking a genuine, authentic question because I did not have that response. In some ways, it felt very real, which then made me go,
the whole movie played out to me. You know those little memes online where it's like the cat texting from home, like, oh, hey, you left the stove on, and it plays out like this little animated text conversation? That was this movie. Mm-hmm. It was like 2 hours of that.
Well, I thought I was the only person who saw this resemblance. It turns out I'm far from the only person who saw this resemblance, but Carolyn, you and I both separately saw the movie Eighth Grade. And I find myself thinking a little bit about this. John Cho and Josh Hamilton both play mm-hmm. these fathers who are fumbling to understand their daughters and their daughters' lives is being conducted in an arena other than the kitchen table, other than where the father expects to be able to have conversations play out. And there's some real similarities between those two movies. Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely saw those. I saw that similarity. I think there's a lot of pop culture and media out there right now that is almost designed to scare parents into what their children are doing online. And I think that this movie is a thriller in that, I mean, the pacing on it, the fact that you could fall asleep during it, it is quiet because it's computer screens. There is something. But the thriller in it really is that, oh my God, your child is doing all of, could be online, doing all this stuff, you know, using Venmo to launder money or something. Just the concept of like your kid doing that. And you kind of not being aware. And
that's like not a new concept, right? Like
not
you can all dig
all.
Back and be like, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, I did. There's a lot of things in this vault of mine that my parents didn't know of, I think.
Right. But somehow with the presence of the world with internet, I oftentimes find myself saying like, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad I did not have social media when I was a teenager.
Oh, I feel the same way.
Well, they would never be tracked at least.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like they had by the time I was in college, like that stuff was around. But I'm really glad I could grow up without having to deal with that, because movies like this in eighth grade kind of show the ramifications of that reality of what it's like to be a teenager and having access to this kind of world.
I like this movie better than you did, Bill, although I don't particularly want to see it again or anything like that. And I liked it for a couple of reasons. One of them is I'm just grateful to see a movie that kind of blends new and old. So there's ways in which this movie effectively uses the new, particularly in that kind of information-rich quality that, you know, a screen that has a couple other screens sitting behind it, and there's just constantly a lot of information churning up there at you. And if you watch this thing pretty carefully, you can figure out a lot of things way faster than John Cho does,
yes.
which I find a little bit frustrating.
There's lots of little Easter eggs.
Yeah, there's just lots of information.
I was just about to say, yeah. I mean, I won't give away the ending, but did anyone kind of piece this together?
I was most of the way there by the time.
Right.
And
I thought that was the disappointing part.
Well, it depends on whether you want to feel smart or dumb. Like I live with somebody who, like, if she's watching the first episode of Game of Thrones, this has actually happened. She was watching the first episode of Game of Thrones and I'd already seen the first season. And she goes, is he going to die? Are they going to kill that guy? Are they going to cut his head? I'm thinking that happens like four episodes from now. How do you know that?
Yeah.
You
Laurie know? Does the same thing. Yeah.
So
I think they may have been overhanded because I knew where we were going, having nothing to do with my earlier Googling. I knew where we were going pretty early because I think they were very heavy-handed with the co-star in terms of tracking that story as it went.
Co-star being Deborah Messing.
I think the costume designer, I just think was a little heavy-handed. There was it was unnecessary for her to be as frantic and as beleaguered and tired as she so quickly appeared.
I would also say, like, look, I love Grace Adler as much as the next guy. I don't think this is one of Deborah Messing's great performances. I do think she comes off as kind of wooden, and it is kind of heavy-handed. And the, you know, the way everything has to be kind of explained point by point toward the end, it just didn't gel for me.
Right. So we have to be careful that we don't spoil.
We won't.
This.
No
so,
spoilers.
No spoilers. So the other thing that I would say about this, first of all, this is like the only thing I've ever enjoyed Deborah Messing in. Apparently, I'm not the next guy. But
I agree.
But. So the new was the computer. The old, to me, is that kind of more Hitchcockian style of thriller. Obviously, this doesn't rise to the level of Hitchcock. But if Hitchcock were working today, he'd try something like this probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dana Stevens from Slade pointed out that Rope, for example, uses the gimmick of one long uninterrupted take. Yeah,
yep.
One shot, which is, of course, parallels a length of Rope. I think he would be doing something like this. Mm-hmm. There are no gunfights. There are no car chases. It's mm-hmm. all kind of worked out at this. I mean, you know, like I was thinking I want to go back and rewatch the 1982 Robert Benton movie Still of the Night, an early Meryl Streep performance where, you know, I mean, those kind of atmospheric movies that don't rely on a lot of violence. I like that kind of movie. I think that this young director loses control of this device. You know, like in the last 20 minutes.
Yes, agreed.
Where he could have kept it more claustrophobic and airless and really mm-hmm. confined us to that computer space and
agreed.
Still gotten everything that he wanted, scared us more than he did. You know, it's too bad. But
yeah, I mean, he faced a really difficult conundrum, right? Which is that as the story unraveled and unfolded, the world as it appeared to John Cho's character got bigger. And instead of forcing himself in the way that you've suggested into the room and the computer, he tried to grasp the rest of the world. And that very first shot where he's trying to capture more of the world, I thought, oh, are we moving away from this device that he set up so far? And when he turns it back to this screen we're watching is the news, you know, the news feed, I go, ah.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways in which he you know, there's actually, we don't have time to get into this. But I mean, in order to make this whole thing work, he really has to do all kinds of.
The beginning worked really well
for
me.
Beautiful.
And I thought one of the really cool things was the progression of technology, how you could see the passing of time in the beginning montage by the different computer and technology.
Mm-hmm.
I latched on to that and thought that was really well done. And then, yeah, I mean, things just, the movie kind of derailed for
All right.
me.
We have to stop there, so we'll have time to make some recommendations afterwards. So let's do that. The movie is Searching. You can either go see it or you don't. I don't think we're going to get upset if you don't go see it. But maybe you could
go
see it.
Yeah,
go see it.
If you can find a theater play.
Right. Tanisha and I say go see it.
Asian stars.
It's not the worst thing Colin ever made me see.
Right. Carolyn just says, make sure you've got gas in the car.
I'm here with one of our pageant contestants, Jonathan McPants, Mr. Guilford, for the interview competition. Jonathan, what would you say is the biggest problem facing the world today?
World peace.
Right, but world peace isn't technically a problem, right?
I still say world peace.
But I said facing the world in my question, and then you said world peace in your answer, which means that 50% of your answer came from my question.
I don't know math.
You're kind of a bozo. You know that?
Trigger warning. You triggered me. Also, clown shaming.
I hate 2018. Okay, today's show was produced by this bozo and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish doesn't need a swimsuit. She is a swimsuit. The part of Bill Curry was played by Bert Parks. We'll be back on Monday with whatever Betsy Kaplan says we have to do. And now, back to Colin.
All right. Time to make some recommendations. We'll start over here. You can't see me pointing at anyone, but I'm pointing at Bill Houston.
I know that I'm over here. First of all, I want to endorse my new band. It's called Cynthia Nixon's Bagel. It's a klezmer band.
Right.
No, but
that was
actually.
It should be like a klezmer folk band because it's got cinnamon and raisins in it, too.
Nice.
Don't make me mix my genres. So my actual endorsement does tie back to an earlier conversation. I love the stuff that gets serious about comedy and is kind of meta about comedy. There's a show I've been watching. It's a Showtime series. They did two seasons of it. I think it was kind of overlooked and underrated. I actually like it quite a bit. It's called I'm Dying Up Here. and it's about comedians in 1970s Los Angeles. And it's about their struggles and their personal lives, but it has a fair bit of scenes of them performing, and it's got some really interesting people in it. And I actually think it's really worth a look, even though it got very mixed reviews. And I guess it's questionable whether there's going to be a season three or not. But I really think it's worth it. I'm enjoying it. It's got almost kind of like a Mad Men feel to it.
All right. Carolyn is frantically Googling her recommendation. So, Tanisha, you go next.
So I'm going to endorse three things. I'm going to endorse the second season of Insecure started 2 weeks ago, yeah. So check that out. I don't know if I endorsed this already, so this may be a repeat, but if it is, see it. Hannah Gadsby's Nanette is a must-see, especially coming off of our conversation today.
We did a nose about it.
What?
Yeah.
How dare I not be on that nose? Anyway.
Carolyn and I were.
That's okay. That's okay. And then this endorsement actually comes off of Jonathan McPant's request, because I just loved this idea, and I will share the link that hopefully they can add to the show page. It is a salted chocolate chip cookie recipe, which is just delish, and it's the weekend, and it's probably going to be cloudy, so it's like the perfect time to bake.
Ooh, all right. We will share a link to that recipe. All right, Carolina, you ready?
Yeah, well, on Tanisha's note, so little known fact, I'm a really good baker. And the secret to good baking is putting salt in whatever you're making because of that salty and sweet. So Cynthia Nixon knows what's up.
I've always found you very salty.
That I am. Okay, so my endorsement is the Netflix. I love Netflix or TV or anything where I don't have to leave the house, because obviously when I try to leave the house, it just derails really quickly into a disaster. But the Netflix show BoJack Horseman is spectacular. It has a new season. It's just really funny. I like it because it's centered in the entertainment world. So for me, there are some things that are oddly relatable, but it's a fun watch.
We should say that this is an animated series in which a horse who is an entertainment star, everybody is sort of a kind of a human-ish body, a biped body, but with an animal head. With an animal head. Will Arnett voices the horse, and then there's a whole lot of people who's working. But
I also am concerned that you guys like congratulated me for using a multi-syllable word there. Yeah.
It's a great show about depression, among other things.
Yes.
But very funny.
Yeah, it's spectacular. So that's my endorsement.
All right. Oh, okay. So we've got so much Netflix for you to do here, because I'm going to add to your burden. So I was also thinking about comedy and Dimitri Martin's Netflix special, I think it's called The Overthinker. This is sort of kind of what I said about Searching. Doesn't need gunfights and doesn't need car crashes. Dimitri Martin is one of those comedians who really doesn't have to get particularly vulgar or aggressive to get you to laugh. He makes you laugh with his mind and with his thoughts, and he really
Safe space for comedy.
He's a safe space for comedy, and there's a gentleness to his work, but he's really, really inventive and just tremendous. Some of the places that his mind goes. So it was just such a joy to watch that. I watched that and the Bill Burr special, which I don't necessarily, unless you're feeling really angry and over constrained by
always
social mores, then watch the Bill Burr thing. You'll have a great time, particularly if you sort of hated everybody who ran for president. It's that special, by the way, is filmed right before the 2016 election, so he doesn't know who the president is going to be, and he has some interesting things to say about both of them. And now I am going to. I was kind of hoping that I would run out of time, so I wouldn't make this endorsement, because it's a little embarrassing or personal or something like that, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to endorse MeUndies. So MeUndies is a subscription underwear service. I heard about it on podcasts. They advertise on podcasts a lot. This is not an advertisement for MeUndies, but now that I get them in the mail once a month, I don't want any other kind of underwear. They're super – and I get the really kind of – I get the really funny ones, I have like the ones – well, I'm going to tell you what's on the ones I'm wearing right now. This is none of your business. But – there's a new development that's very important. Even if MeUndies was not maybe going to be for you, it's going to be for a certain kind of people, because they have just announced their Star Wars line of MeUndies. So these are incredibly comfortable underwear, underpants, whatever you want to call them.
Is it only for men?
I don't know that there are women's things. I've just never – you know, that's not my territory. You know,
I don't. Fair. Don't be so binary.
Yeah,
right.
I don't.
I mean, you had me at Star Wars underpants. Yeah. I was down for
the underwear of the month club.
I love this. You are the captain of underpants.
I am not the kind of person who goes on the internet looking at women's underwear. I just want to say that. So I don't know whether they're women's underwear or not, but there definitely are men's underwear, and there's some really great ones. But order the fun ones. There's some service. There are women's. I'm being told there are women's MeUndies. Don't just order the serviceable ones. Order the ones that have like little dog faces all over them or something. Or
this feels like a nicely full circle episode. You know, yeah. We started talking about Rihanna's Savage and Fenty, and we end with MeUndies.
There you go.
All the underwears.
All right. Sit around in the in your MeUndies eating a bagel and watching Netflix, and you'll have a great weekend.
Waterberry, Oliveberry, Woodberry, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.